Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, April 7th, 2011. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. With this week, Brewing Like a Colonist. Frank Clark from Colonial Williamsburg in Virginia joins us to talk about what the founding fathers of the United States might have been drinking back in the day. If you're new to home brewing or would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. Also, you can find our brewer's logbooks to help you log and track your batches of beer. You can find me on Twitter. My username is Basic Brewing, all one word. Also, you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james, and our show page is at facebook.com/basicbrewing. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon, think of us and click on our associate link first. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you this show, and we appreciate your support. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site, too. And you can now find our Basic Brewing iPhone and Android podcast apps on their respective stores, and we're on the BlackBerry podcast directory, too. Let's take a quick look into the mailbag. Dustin from Rochester, New York, writes in with a twist on the brew-in-a-bag technique, reiterated mashing, brew-in-a-bag style. Dustin says, I've been brewing all-grain brew in bag batches on my stove with a 5-gallon pot. I love how simple it is, but have been limited to 2.5-gallon batches or 5-gallon partial mashes. Yesterday, I decided to try something new. I used a typical 5-gallon batch recipe that calls for 10 pounds of grain. I filled the brew pot with 4 gallons of water, brought it up to strike temperature, and added half of the grain. I mashed for 1 hour. After the hour, I pulled out the bag, gave it a good squeeze, and dumped out the spent grain. The grain had absorbed some of the water, so I topped off the brew pot to 4 gallons, brought it back up to strike temp, and added the bag and the remaining 5 pounds of grain. I then did a second 1-hour mash. I checked my efficiency and was happy to find it right at 75%. Post-boil, I ended up with 2 3/4 gallons of wort with a gravity of 1.100 or 1100. I added this to the fermenter and topped off with 2.5 gallons of water or 2 1/4 gallons of water to bring the total to 5 gallons. I checked the gravity and it was right at 1055, exactly what the recipe called for. So Dustin says, with this technique, I'm able to brew 5-gallon batches of mid-gravity beer and 2.5 to 3-gallon batches of a much higher gravity on my stove with a 5-gallon pot. The biggest drawbacks are adding an hour for the second mash and whatever other negatives are associated with a partial boil. Although after listening to the March 4th, 2010 episode of our podcast, where the partial boil and hop utilization slash wort darkening experiments were conducted, I don't consider this a big issue. Dustin says, do you think there are any reasons why a partial all-grain boil is a bad idea? Well, no, I can't think of any major reasons offhand other than the added hour of mashing. And even at that, Dustin says that he believes that his brew day was only 5.5 hours, which is around the same time for my brew day with a full volume mash. You know, when you take into account that it takes less time to heat up and cool down smaller volumes of liquid, you know, maybe it's a wash, so to speak. One suggestion that I would like to make to improve the process would be to sparge the grain in the bag in a separate pot with a bit of hot water after each mash. You could use the same amount of water that you use to top off the kettle before putting in the second half of the grain, and that should give you even better efficiency, although 75% is doing pretty good already. So it sounds like a good workaround if you have a small stove or a small brew pot. Just do a reiterated mash. Mash twice. Thanks for that, Dustin. Now, I do want to move on to the conversation with Frank because we chatted for a good long time, and I enjoyed it, by the way. I was at a good beer tasting of Firestone Walker beers at Mark Smith's house a while back, which was a wondrous thing, by the way, when Ken Gillespie suggested this topic, and big thanks to Ken for helping to set this up. And I want to give a shout-out to Stephen Davis and the members of Cask in Williamsburg, Virginia, the homebrew club there. They are planning a big brew in May to get together at Aleworks Brewery to brew colonial recipes. So if you are in that area, you might want to look into that. Sounds like a lot of fun. So let's go back in time a couple hundred years with colonial brewer Frank Clark. Well, Frank Clark, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Great. Thanks for having me.
I asked the people out there on Twitter and Facebook. I said, I am interviewing an expert on colonial brewing. Give me your questions. And they responded with a lot of questions. But probably the easiest one or the best one to start out with is, how does one get to be an expert on colonial brewing? That's from Kevin. And I guess we could answer that by just introducing yourself and who you are and what you do.
Right. Well, you have to drink a lot of beer and be really, really, really old. just kidding. It actually was sort of an offshoot of my job. I've started working at Colonial Williamsburg about 21 years ago, and I was doing school tours, actually, originally at one point, and in the summertime we didn't get a lot of school groups, so they sort of farmed us out. So they sent me to the kitchen one summer, and I liked it, and I went back again the next summer, and I worked in the kitchen again, and a full-time position came up there, and I applied for it and got it. And as part of the historic trades department at Colonial Williamsburg, the foodways department, as we're known, which is basically the kitchens that we operate, is supposed to serve an apprenticeship. It's a period of about 5 to 7 years where you're basically learning the trade and then go on to teach others and become a journeyman in your trade. And as part of our apprenticeship in foodways, we needed to find a subject to research in the 18th century. And as I started to look at subjects, my brother-in-law happened to give me a homebrew kit for Christmas, and so I started thinking, well, why not research beer and brewing in the 18th century? And that was about 17 or so years ago, and I've been working on it ever since. Basically, you become an expert in it, if I can call myself an expert, by reading the brewing literature of the period and trying to understand the processes that they were using and how they relate to, you know, the modern world and what we think of as beer today.
We got a whole lot of questions on, you know, asking about what the state of brewing was back then. You know, Alan asks, how common was home brewing and what adjustments were necessary in the new world? I mean, you're dealing with the 1800s or the 1700s. So, you know, a lot of people have been here a while since then. But so maybe not necessarily adjusting from the old world to the new world. But what was the state of home brewing and brewing in general at that time?
Well, it's interesting. It's clearly different between England and America. Unfortunately, the records are far better in England than they are here in America. So we know a lot more about the English situation, really, than we do about the colonial ones. But it's clear in England in the 18th century that the simply creates a transition from, in the early part of the 18th century, most people were drinking homebrewed beer. By the end of the 18th century, most people in England are drinking commercial brewed beer. Hmm. So it is in that time period that people switch from primarily brewing their own beer to drinking commercial beer. And the primary reason was the massive production and the industrialization of the brewing industry in England related to the porter, the brewing of porter. And that really changes the whole beer world in a big way, because that's the first time in history where people were actually drinking more commercially made beer than their own beer. Hmm. So that's a big change. Here in America, I don't think that change occurs as early as it does in England. In some places, like, say, Philadelphia, Boston, New York, it may well have, although their industry is still a little bit slower than the English to fully take off. Here in the South, we are much slower. And probably, looking at the records in Williamsburg anyway, there's an awful lot of home brewing going on around here. So here in the South and in other places that don't have a real big commercial brewing industry, there's still a lot of home brewing. But in England, by this period, the commercial industry is totally taking off and kind of knocking out the home brewers. And in fact, you see people complaining about it as well, you know, saying that, you know, it was much better when people made their own beer, and now they're just buying anything that commercial brewers produce.
Of course, back then we read that, we hear that brewing was kind of a matter of self-defense because the drinking water wasn't as safe as it is today.
Absolutely. And that's especially true here in Williamsburg and in Virginia. There's very, very big problems with water. And, you know, milk isn't necessarily a safe alternative either. Both water and milk could kill you 200 years ago. Beer, however, and cider were safe. So those were the everyday beverages for most people. And they thought of beer as a wholesome, healthy, and nutritious beverage. And they were absolutely right.
So Stephen asks, were our founding fathers drinking really strong brews, or was it all just raw courage?
Well, I'm not sure what he meant by raw courage, but you do find a wide range of beers. The everyday beverage that people are drinking is what was referred to as small beer. We have to back up just a little bit and explain a little about the English brewing process, because they do it very differently from people today. In the 18th century, the English brewed three batches of beer from the same pile of grain. They would add water to it one time, run it off, and make what they called strong ale. They would take the same grain, add water to it again, mash it a second time, run it off, and make what they called a table beer. And if they did it a third time, the third runnings were called small beer. Typically, what we found through various experimentation and through brewing program, which we do in the spring and fall every year at Colonial Williamsburg, is that the first batch, depending on the amount of grain you're using, is going to run around 8 to 10%. Second one, 7 to 6, and the small beer somewhere around 4, 3 to 4. So, probably on an everyday basis, people were drinking beer that's just about as strong as what most commercial American brews out there are now. Here in Virginia, a lot of people did another alternative, which was make their beer out of molasses. And so by using that, they're speeding up the process a little bit, but it's still probably going to come out to a pretty similar strength in alcohol.
So Danny asks, did they use any ingredients that aren't available or considered impractical today? And if so, how do they go about using them? So is there anything like molasses that that they would have used for beers back then that we wouldn't consider a typical beer ingredient today?
Sure. In fact, there's some, in the quarters of the period, there's some rather deadly things, including opium and laudanum, and a berry known as faba bina, which was a berry apparently coming from Southeast Asia. It was used there by the natives to knock out fish. They would mash this berry up, and they'd throw it in the stream. The fish would all float to the top, you know, and they'd gather them up. And apparently it had a similar effect on porter drinkers. In fact, the best description is that people drinking it, you could tell because they made a motion like a spaniel quitting water. And if you think about that, you know, the dogs that do that involuntary twitching when they're quitting water, that's got to be a pretty powerful nerve toxin if it's making people twitch uncontrollably. So all sorts of things ended up in beer in the 18th century. The English have no purity laws in regard to brewing. And in fact, some of the very first food and safety laws were directed at the brewers. They're passed by Parliament in the 1830s, directed at a group called Brewers Chemists, who were supplying these porter brewers with all these various concoctions, including things like one of them was the bitter bean that we were describing there earlier. Another was salt of steel, and various compounds like that. Elder juice you found, elder berries you found in porter. Porter, one of the essential ingredients, was a burnt sugar mixture they called essential bina. And also licorice root, an extract from licorice. yesterday day called Spanish juice. Both of those were essential ingredients in porters at the time. So yeah, there are all sorts of ingredients. Here in America, where there isn't as much barley, you find ingredients like pumpkin. There's actually an article published in our local newspaper in 1774 on how to make beer from corn stalks. Chop up the corn stalks, and you boil them, and sort of strain all that stuff out, get the sugar out of the corn stalks, you boil that with hops, and then you ferment it. Molasses was a common substitute, because molasses coming out of the Caribbean is dirt cheap in the colonial period, and probably much more available here in the South than barley was. And so that's one of the reasons why I think Virginians did it. The other reason they used the molasses was that it was quicker. You didn't have to mash, you didn't have to strain, you didn't have to mess with anything. You just threw the molasses, some wheat bran, and some hops in the pot, boil it all up, strain it out and ferment it. You know, so it's one of the questions was whether or not they did all grain or extract. Well, actually, they did both. They did their extract with molasses rather than a malt extract, but they did have a version of extract during 200 years ago.
Yeah, that's funny. Jamie,
probably both households did that rather than the full grain mash brewing, at least here in the South.
Yeah, I think Jamie was asking that as a joke, but
I'm sure he was, but I thought and I laughed because, yeah, in a way they did do some extract brewing back then.
Yeah, it's funny. Sometimes you ask a question, you know, just as a you know, tossing it off or just as a joke, and you come up with a good answer. So there you go.
Fair enough. Exactly.
So what about hops? I mean, we had David asking about hops, and Gene says, "What hop and malt varieties did they have then, or were they? Would we recognize any of the hop and malt varieties that they would have back then?"
Well, the hop has been in Virginia since 1621. You see them planted here as early as 1621, so very early on. And probably the varieties that are being planted are one of the three or four members of the group known as Kent Goldings today. They're probably the oldest still in use English hop today. They're isolated theoretically by a man named William Golding, although recent research is cast some question upon exactly which Golding was responsible for isolating these varieties of hops over in Kent, England. And that was sometime around the 1790s. So that is probably the most authentic, shall we say, hop in terms of what they may have been using at the time. The problem is that over 200 years, selective breeding and modern agriculture and even, you know, genetic engineering to some degree have improved even the strain of the hop we know as Kent Golding to a much, much higher percentage than it was 200 years ago. If you look at the hop rates, they're using some pretty amazingly high amounts of hops that if modern brewers using modern hops used, you would have a very different effect because the alpha acids in these were probably somewhere around half of what a modern Kent Golding now. And Kent Goldings aren't high. They, you know, typically run at the 5 to 6 AAU range. I would imagine the 18th century ones being closer to 2 to 3.
And I assume that that barley was just barley, whether it was did they have two-row barley back then? Or
They had both 2 and 6 row barleys. That they did. And they malted both of those. They also malted a lot of wheat in this area because they aren't growing a lot of barley in this particular portion of Virginia. It's not the right climate for it. It's a little hot around here. Jefferson, for example, made his beer out of wheat rather than barley, and probably a number of other Virginians as well were doing that, or at least a mixture of the two. But yes, they do have a wide varieties of barley, but once again, the dietastic strength, you know, the sugars and the proteins that are in our modern varieties of barley are probably, I'm finding, you know, from working things out, somewhere around 2 to 3 times what they were at the time. So even the basic barleys have been vastly improved over the last 200 years. So if you look at grain bills, they're calling for huge amounts of grain as well. And we kind of didn't really realize or think about this when we first started this program. And so we followed the recipe and basically cut down to exactly. And when we did it, we ended up making a porter that was 14.5% alcohol. We called Vlad the Impaler. It was interesting stuff, but certainly not what they were drinking 200 years ago. So we started at that point to think about, well, okay, what did we do wrong? And we looked at the math, and the math was basically right. And we thought, you know, what we didn't account for was the change in the quality of the ingredients over 200 years. And so, you know, by doing this and by looking at some of the early sacrometers, which were what they called hydrometers in the 18th century, and then figuring out a scale for those things, we were able to look and realize that the porter was really consistently 6.5% alcohol. So we actually, you know, ended up reducing that down and cutting the grain bill by over half to get it down to, because of the change in the quality of the ingredients over 200 years.
So if you were brewing beer either at home or in for a pub or a commercial brewery, would you be malting your own grain?
Could be. Yeah, there are separate trades. There are maltsters and there are brewers, but there are plenty of breweries that also had to do their own malting for one reason or another. It varied from brewery to brewery, but it wouldn't be a surprise. You might have, you know, one guy doing that, one guy doing the brewing or something like that combined together as a business. You don't see anybody just advertising as a maltster in Virginia. I've yet to find someone who advertised. Actually, I found one guy who came over from England with that skill and doesn't seem to be able to get employed. Hmm. So it seems like here in the South, there's not a lot of malting going on. And in fact, Robert Beverly, who wrote a description of Virginia in the very end of the period, or the early part of the 18th century, actually describes it and says that Virginians do very little malting. They are trying to work with malting corn and some of the other sort of local things a little bit as well. But I think malt is probably more imported, and that's another reason why people use molasses. They can get that for cheaper and easier.
And it's like you said, it's already converted. You've got your sugars
yeah.
available for fermentation right there.
Exactly.
So let's talk a little bit about techniques in general, and then I want to get into your specific setup. Tom asks, how did they handle sanitization at the time, or were all beers meant to be drunk fresh to avoid souring?
That's an interesting question because they didn't handle sanitation. They hadn't invented it. Okay, so the concept of sanitation doesn't exist in their mind the way it exists in a homebrewer's mind today. Every brewing manual stresses the importance of cleanliness. They talk about scrubbing out your casks and your tubs and everything that's going to contact your beer in boiling water and with sand and scouring it as clean as possible. But that's about all they can do. And they're dealing with wood. Now, the second part of the question is the tricky part, because to us, the concept of a sour beer is that it's gone bad. But I think certainly part of the flavor profile of porter in the 18th century was the fact that it was aged for 2 years in wooden containers. And there's no way you can age anything for 2 years in a wooden container without some sort of, you know, souring going on. So what's going to end up happening is that the beer would sour. However, that doesn't mean they didn't drink it that way. Just like the Belgians like sour ale, I think one of the reasons that porter was popular was what the porter brewers did was blend very, very sour porter with fresher porter. Mm. To create a medium blend kind of a thing, a consistent product. And so what they would do is have a number of vats of porter that were, you know, 2-3 years old and very, very sour. And then they'd mix, you know, just a little portion of that into a bunch of other barrels of reasonably fresh porter and produce a uniform taste that way. So sourness is actually part of the flavor profile of some of the 18th century beers. And so in that sense, they didn't think of it as a bad thing, but as a good thing. However, there are also endless recipes for curing a beer once it's gone bad. Foxing, what we would think of as the skunk smell. There's a number of references to that and how to cure it. Souring of any type, typically what you're doing is grinding up chalk, combining it with sugar and flour, making balls out of this stuff and throwing it into your beer. So theoretically, I guess the chalk is sort of balancing some of the sourness of the acidic acid bacteria that are growing in there. They are expecting a certain degree of infection, some of which were acceptable, some of which weren't. But in many cases, they're probably still going to drink the beer anyway. Whereas we would, you know, as modern people, we expect a consistency in food and manufactured products that is completely impossible to achieve 200 years ago.
Now, there are a bunch of craft brewers out today. There are a bunch of craft brewers out today that are going for the sour styles and going for the sour, you know, wood-aged, interesting, you know, quote-unquote spoiled beers, you know, to some people, but playing with that flavor palette in a way that, you know, maybe the colonists would find familiar.
Sure. And you know, I think there's also, to some degree, something to be said about the boring nature of most people's everyday diet. The poor Virginian, the poor Englishman is eating mostly one-pot meals, porridges, soups, and stews. And so something that's flavorful and unique and exciting in your mouth, you know, is going to be interesting and different from all the other stuff you're eating, which isn't very exciting or interesting or different. If you follow me. So I think maybe a sour beer is even more interesting to someone who's been eating cornmeal mush all day than it might be to someone who has a wide variety of food choices like we do in front of them, you know.
Yeah, spices may have been expensive or hard to come by back then.
Sure, in some cases, yeah. Now, they're also used in beers as well. There are plenty of spice beers. In fact, we work with a beer called Mump. And apparently this beer originated in Brunswick in northern Germany, and it came over to England with the Georges when the Germans take the throne in England. It was originally in the German form a medicinal beer. It had anywhere from 15 to 20 different medicinal herbs in it. The English seemed to drop out a lot of the herbs, although they sometimes kept about 2 or 3 of them, typically sage and something called bog myrtle you see a lot in your mum. But they changed for those spices, cinnamon, coriander, cardamom, cayenne pepper even, and grains of paradise. And it is much like a Belgian wit beer in many ways. It's made of wheat and oat and barley, very light in color. In fact, the period description is that you can read a newspaper through a glass of it. So very clear and spiced, highly spiced ale. So they're using spices in beers intentionally as well as a flavoring, too. And you see ginger a lot in beers at this time, lots of beers that have ginger in them. Some cinnamon as well.
Now let's talk about your setup. If we come and can we, first of all, if we go to Colonial Williamsburg, can we see you brew as part of the demonstration there?
At certain times, yes. We have 4 brewing programs in the spring and 4 in the fall. They're always on a Saturday or a Sunday. And they'll have the dates on all that posted on Colonial Williamsburg's website, history.org. And so on those days, yeah, we're doing the demonstration in the Palace Scullery. Program starts at 10 in the morning and ends at 3:30, and we go through the process of making a batch of beer. And so people can kind of come and go throughout the day and see, you know, different stages of mashing and boiling and the straining and all of that. We're basically making about a 10-gallon batch, or we end up with somewhere around 8 when all is said and done. So what would really be considered small-scale home brewing by the period standards, and we make we probably get about 15 different beers that we have on our palate as such from the period that we've reproduced. Luckily, we were also trying to get people a chance to taste those beers. Unfortunately, we can't serve the ones that we make because of the process in which they're made, but we've gotten a local microbrewery, Williamsburg Ale Works, to help us to scale up at least one of the recipes. It's called Old Stitch Brown Ale, and it's now for sale in our taverns. So people coming here will also be able to taste one of the 18th century beers, or at least a modern version of it here at our tavern.
Very cool. So talk about your setup. Kind of take us through your brew day, and as you take us through chronologically, take us through the gear that you're using to brew your beer.
Sure. We have a 12-gallon copper pot, very large copper pot, which is our boiling and water heater as such. We have a very large wooden mash tub that we do our mashing in. And then we have a tub which has basically no bottom, or in fact a brass screen at the bottom, which is the strainer for the grain, and then yet another tub which the wort will go into. And so we start by heating the water. The thing about that is the temperature, of course. Mr. Fahrenheit invented his thermometer in the 1730s and his temperature scale to go with it, but they're very expensive, and they're not in common use until towards the end of the 18th century. So probably about half the time, if I'm feeling adventurous, we'll do it without a thermometer. And about the other half the time, we'll cheat a little bit and stick a modern one in there just to make sure we're as close as we think we are. But it's getting to the point after, 15 years, 17 years of doing this, that I can look at the pot water and pretty much tell within about 5 degrees what it is. And so that's part of the skill that you had to develop to be a brewer 200 years ago, was to be able to judge water without a thermometer. And so we get the water up to temperature, we put that into the grain in the mash tub, and we let it mash. Usually the mash times went up as the batches went down. Remember, we were talking about the fact that they've got 3 runnings off the same grain. Well, the first mash was the shortest, second mash was a little longer, and the third mash was generally like 2 to 2.5 to 3 hours. To avoid having to be there all day boiling 3 different mashes and making 3 separate beers, we're producing what was referred to in the period as an entire. So what we'll do is one mash, run it off, let it sit, do another mash, and then combine them both together and boil them. So they're combined together in one pot as an entire batch.
So you're essentially batch sparging, as we know it today in homebrewing.
Yes. In fact, the process of sparging seems to be invented by the Scots. I've seen it, the first real mention of it that I see clearly is in a Scottish brewing manual from 1830. So it's coming in just a little bit later than our time period. And it seems to start in Scotland and sort of spread from there to the rest of the brewing industry.
So I've sidetracked you now, Frank. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Yeah,
you've collected your wort. Now where do we go?
Okay, yes. So once we've gotten all the wort into the tub, it goes into the pot with the hop. Actually, the hops have been in the wort since the first running. This is what many times is today called first wort hopping. In other words, you run the wort off right onto the hops and keep them in there the whole time. And then we'll bring all that up to a boil. The hops, that's the only addition. They generally don't do, second and third or late additions, although dry hopping is fairly common in the period. You will see in the commercial brewers of the period that they run through a hop pack after the whole thing is run off. But we don't have a large enough setup for that at the moment, so we basically just do
do that, the single first wort hopping as such. So we boil the wort with the hops. Generally, the boil times can be a little bit longer than they are today, depending on how much you want to reduce the volume, how strong you want to make the beer. And then we strain all the hops and cool the liquid down. Now, in the 18th century, that was done by pouring it into what's called a cool ship. And a cool ship is a big, long, flat, lead-lined tray. We decided it probably wasn't a great idea to let our beer sit on lead, especially considering it's sitting on lead and especially considering it's exposed to the air while it's doing so. So we use more modern methods of cooling the beer a little more rapidly behind the scenes. Before we pitch the yeast in for a minute, just because we really don't want to let the beer sit on a big lead lined tray. So we do cheat a little bit there and make one concession to modern times in our process when it comes to the cooling and the fermenting, which we'll do with glass. Glass carboys actually were around in the 18th century, so I don't feel bad about using them. The only thing they didn't use was the airlock.
You mentioned yeast. Huntington asks, where did they get their yeast? It's not like they could run down. He says it's not like they could run down to the local homebrew shop. He says the proverbial holy stick of fermentation, as we've seen it referenced mostly in Germany, I think. So the previous batch of beer is where they got the yeast.
Yeah, generally. All beers at this time are unfiltered. So any keg of beer will do. There's some yeast in the bottom of it. Any bottle of beer will do. There's some yeast in the bottom of it. So yeast is everywhere. Sometimes you don't even see it sold very often, in fact, because it's so available. And it seems to be something you probably borrow from your neighbor, rather than anything else.
Or you could go down to the bakery maybe and get some yeast down there.
Sure, absolutely, absolutely. It's all the same thing at that time. There's no separate brewer's yeast or baker's yeast. Everybody's using yeast. And in fact, it's interesting that you mentioned the holy stick. One of the processes of preserving yeast at this time was to take a whisk, which is actually lots of birch branches tied together, dip it into the beer while it was fermenting, and let it dry. Dip it in and let it dry so that you're getting the yeast foam off the top of the fermenting beer embedded into this whisk. And then the next batch of beer, you simply take the whisk, stir up the beer with it, and off you go.
Sounds like you're making a yeast candle or something.
Almost in a way, right onto your whisk. You could wait till the beer was fermented, siphon it off, and then press out the yeast into a yeast cake and keep that around. We see descriptions of doing that. We make what's called beer roll-ups. Sometimes we spread the yeast out on what we like to call beer roll-ups. We spread it out on a sheet, let it dry, and it sort of cracks. It looks kind of like mud, and it's sort of tacky, and you roll that up, and there you go. So they had a lot of ways of keeping it simply in bottles down in the cellar or down in a well for short-term. Because yeast was typically, when they talk about yeast, they talk about it as a liquid, because that's almost always the way they got it, was in liquid form. So it's not in a dry or powdered, although it might be pressed in a cake.
So they might not have known about the microbiology of yeast, but they knew that it was the magic stuff.
Sure, exactly.
So I know that you say you don't want to share you don't feel comfortable sharing the organization's specific recipes. But if someone were to be on a quest to make a colonial-style beer, can you give us some hints as far as, what kinds of ingredients we would use or sources that you used? Or, head us down that road.
There's a book out in England a number of years ago by a man named Dr. John Harrison. He ran what was called the Durden Park Beer Circle, and they produced a book called Brewing Old English Beers, which has lots of old recipes that they had converted in that. Sip Through Time was another book that's come out fairly recently that has, I think, a few old beer recipes in it as well. You see frequently George Washington's recipe for small beer, which is a molasses beer, as we were talking about as well. And that one is one that's not too hard to follow, really. So there's some out there in terms of the actual recipes. The ones we work with, the reason I want to share them in the sense is that what we've had to do is brewing manuals were written for professional brewers. And professional brewers in the 18th century are making pretty large batches of beer, typically somewhere in the 400-gallon neighborhood. So we had to do quite a bit of work to reduce these 400-gallon batches down to 10-gallon batches. And so that's kind of the part that we want to keep as our propriety, is the whole process of doing all that. But like I say, there are a number of people that have done similar kinds of things and have published those sorts of things. As far as ingredients go, the Kent Golding is a good choice in terms of hops. That's really the only one we use. You could go with Fuggles. They're later, the 1840s. And the cluster hop here in America, which is a cross between Europeans and a wild American hop, was also a very big hop in the early and mid-19th century here in America. So if you're going a little later than the 18th century, that's a good hop to work with as well. For barley, we tend to use a lot of Maris Otter because that's one of the older ones that's out there still these days. We try to avoid any of the crystal malts, because the crystal malts and the black malts don't come along until Mr. Wheeler invents his patent drum in 1818 to make those things. So we tend to stay away a little bit from that. We love the brown malt. I recommend brown malt in just about any colonial style beer that you're putting out. There's, I think Paul's is still the only company that's making real brown malt, but that's the essence of a real porter. You need the brown malt for that, along with the burnt sugar and the licorice root. Let's see what else. For yeast, frankly, there's just no way we're going to get an 18th century yeast strain today. Yeast has just changed in too much over that period. And frankly, I don't think you'd want one, because they had no way of isolating single strains of yeast 200 years ago. So probably just about everyone was a combination of four or five different strains, probably about three or four different bacteria as well. We just use modern brewers yeast, usually whip breads, frankly, because that seems to work well.
So how would you describe the character if we go to the pub and order one of your beers, or the ones that are based on your recipe? How would you describe the character of that beer?
The Old Stitch brown ale has a bit of a chocolatey kind of a flavor to it, a bit of a coffee type of a flavor to it. It's pretty rich and malty. It's 4.5% alcohol, so it's a nice session beer. The colonial reenactors love it, I'll put it that way. And it's one of my favorites as well.
So they don't use it for courage before the battle, do they?
Who knows? I stay away from all those muskets whenever I can.
Well, I live very near a Civil War battlefield, and the local liquor store gets a lot of business during that time as well.
Yes, indeed.
They provisions. That's what they're looking for, provisions.
Hey, well, that's how the army ran in the 18th century as well. So things never change.
Well, this has been a lot of fun. Is there anything else that you want to mention that we haven't covered in this in our chat? You've mentioned the website, history.org.
Yes, and for those of you that may be interested in food as well as beer, I recommend the section on our section on history.org called History is Served. Every 2 weeks we put up a new 18th century recipe. We'll have the original recipe and we'll have a modern one to do at home. So if any of the brewers also like to cook, take a look at History is Served and see if you might find some recipes there for cooking. I'm actually hoping to put up a small beer recipe up there as well sometime here in the not too distant future.
Oh, well, great. If you get a chance to do that, drop me a line, and I'll let everybody know and put a link to our website.
Sure.
Or link to your website from our
No problem. In fact, we were talking about that the other day because that's one we're not going to do with Aleworks because no one wants to make a molasses beer. So that'd be a good one to post up on the web.
One more question. I take it you guys take the do you act as if you're in that period when people come to Colonial Williamsburg? I mean, if someone
we are actually in the modern times, dressed in the clothing of the period and using the equipment of the period, but using the vocabulary of the 21st century.
Okay.
There are some of my coworkers, however, who are immersed in the period, what we like to call character interpreters or people of the past, and they are strictly their vocabulary ends at 1775. But in the historic trade department, because we're dealing with foods and things, we really need to be able to talk from a modern viewpoint so we can really explain our trade better. It's hard to do that in character, you know.
Yeah, years ago we went to the Plymouth colony.
Right. And they're all characters.
Yeah, we would just stroll into somebody's house while they were fixing lunch, you know, which is a bit unusual. And at one time we walked into this lady's house and she was cooking lunch there, you know, chopping potatoes or whatever. And I said, "What do you think of these people just walking into your house and strolling all around your village, all these strangers?" And she said, "Well, there must have been a shipwreck." So
there you go. Exactly.
But it was a lot of fun going there, and I hope that one day I'll be able to visit you guys.
Yeah, please do. And in fact, yeah. In addition to the small beer recipe, we're working on a video of the brewing of porter, which will eventually get up there on our website as well. So I'll keep you in the loop when those things get through editing and all the jazz that's got to happen with that.
Excellent. Well, Frank, you've done well for having a cold. You haven't sneezed or coughed once, I don't think. So
I took a bunch of my Alka-Seltzer Plus cold medicine before you called, so I figured
ye oldie Alka-Seltzer Plus.
Exactly.
Well, Frank, I certainly appreciate your time.
All right, take care.
Well, thanks again to Frank for the great information and for talking to me, even though he had a cold. He did a good job. And I'll post a link to the video that is on the Colonial Williamsburg site featuring Frank talking about his beers. And you get to take a peek at his homebrew setup there. Nicely produced video, by the way. And also, I'm going to post a link to George Washington's small beer recipe in the description of this episode as well on basicbrewingradio.com. And you get to see that recipe in his handwriting on the New York Public Library page. So let me know if you try to brew it. And I'll also post those links on our show page on Facebook as well. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. You can check out our latest DVD, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, and our 2011 Brewer's Logbooks, still in stock. Check out our online store for those, and you can also check out our other DVDs, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits, too. We've got combo deals on our site to save you a couple of bucks, and you can check out our shirts in the store, too. You can see a fine listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. And we appreciate all those fine vendors. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Rain for sleeping and relaxation. And the Universal Rug Rake. Tom?
The Universal Rug Rake.
Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We appreciate your support. Don't forget our associate links to the American Homebrewers Association or BYL Magazine on our site, too. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.